everyone, and welcome to Qualitative Conversations, a podcast series hosted by the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group of the American Educational Research Association. I am Jory Hall, a professor in the Department of Educational Psychology at the University of Illinois at Chicago. I also serve as the chair of the Egon Guba Award for Outstanding Contributions to Qualitative Research for the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group. I am beyond excited today to be joined by Dr. Giovanni Dazzo, who was the recipient of the 2023 QRSIGS Outstanding Dissertation Award for his dissertation titled Restorative Validity: Exploring How Critical Participatory Inquiry Can Promote Peace, Justice, and Healing. Giovanni is an interdisciplinary researcher and evaluator and assistant professor at the University of Georgia. His work is focused on critical theoretical approaches to research and evaluation methodologies. In particular, he is interested in exploring the intersections of validity and ethics within critical participatory forms of inquiry and the ways in which research and social policies can better be informed by communities. His work has been featured in a multitude of peer-reviewed journals, such as the International Journal of Qualitative Methods, Educational Action Research, Cultural Studies, Critical Methodologies, and Conflict Resolution Quarterly. Giovanni is also the co-author of the recently published textbook by Sage called Critical Participatory Inquiry, an Interdisciplinary Guide. Giovanni, it is a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you, Jory. It's a pleasure to be here. You make me sound so good.
Well, it's easy based on all the fabulous things you've done. Are you ready to get started, Giovanni?
Yeah, let's get started.
Great. So I was thinking that our audience would greatly appreciate learning more about your dissertation work. Can you just talk a little bit about your dissertation, maybe about its scope?
Yeah, so the dissertation really focused on a long-term critical participatory action research project in Guatemala. And I partnered with an organization that conducts forensic anthropology. It's the Forensic Anthropology Foundation of Guatemala. So essentially, in their day-to-day, they investigate possible mass grave sites that resulted from the country's 36-year armed conflict, which happened from 1960 to 1996. And then they work closely with communities who witnessed and experienced those atrocities to document the stories of those who were forcibly disappeared by the government. And they then extract DNA from living family members, exhume human remains from mass grave sites, and then attempt to match the DNA so they can identify those who were disappeared. So I worked alongside the Forensic Anthropology Foundation of Guatemala, or FAFG, and a Cachical-speaking Maya community to see how we could all together as a research collective explore how the research process could be made more restorative. And really, if you start to think about it, the work of FAFG is literally extractive to communities. They're pulling DNA from swabs, they're digging into the earth, and they're hoping to produce a match. Unfortunately, the success rate at the moment is just 14% because these human remains have been in the ground anywhere between 28 to 64 years. And those who witnessed the atrocities happen, they continue to pass away as time goes by. So we really sought to form the basis for this conceptual and methodological framework called restorative validity. Truthfully, I stopped calling it a framework because journal reviewers kept asking, is it a theoretical framework, a conceptual framework, a methodological framework? So I started calling it what it is, and it's an agenda. It's a call to action. And we really wanted to explore and understand the factors that aid or impede community participation in research and the supposed transformative nature of inquiry. And I wrote it as a three-article dissertation. really interested in working through theories of restorative justice within and beyond methodology, and then documenting our work in various ways.
Wow. So lots to unpack there. I'm excited to dig in just a little bit more. You really did a little bit share about your methodological focus. I just want to go into that a little bit more, if you don't mind. And I found it really intriguing how you switch things up a little bit in terms of your methodological focus. And it sounds like these days you're calling it more of an agenda. Can you say more about that? And in particular, I'm interested in any challenges that you had with your agenda in that context.
Right. So, yeah, as I mentioned, I wrote it as a three-article dissertation. And to start, the first manuscript, I titled it, How Does It Feel to Be My Research Problem on Restorative mm-hmm. Validity? And in that manuscript, I was interested in seeing and reviewing how they're interrelated research orientations. And we produce these research orientations, three orientations, an orientation toward relationships, an orientation toward justice, and an orientation toward liberation, and then how those are situated across different disciplines. And so the disciplines were critical theories or critical social theories, research methodology, particularly from critical quantitative participatory action research and transformative and participatory program evaluation. Mm-hmm. And then what I called peace, rights, and justice studies, which included everything from restorative and transformative justice, theories of reconciliation, and peace and conflict studies. So one of the challenges was really trying to map these concepts across disparate fields and trying to understand and unpack how those working within restorative justice and also within critical methodologies really think about the tensions within terms like restoration, reconciliation, and recognition. And the purpose there was really to think dialectically like a critical theorist and understand those tensions rather than to place a value of saying participation is good or reconciliation is good, but to really question how we can produce inquiry or forms of inquiry that are actually restorative, not only for who we call the researched, but also the researcher. And I think we often lose sight as researchers that we also need to restore our own humanity and also the humanity behind the research process. So in that first manuscript, How Does It Feel to Be My Research Problem? Much credit to W.E.B. Du Bois, who first said in his book, Souls of Black Folks from 1899, how does it feel to be a problem? And in that case, he was asking Black Americans about their double consciousness, how it was to mm-hmm. view themselves through the guise of the white man. And I started to think about, you know, for whom is inquiry transformative? For the researcher, researched, both. And I started to think about, you know, what happens when participants only see themselves through our eyes, through the eyes of researchers. And I wanted to complicate that a bit. So that first manuscript was really an overview of all of those theories across those disciplines. And then the second manuscript was called Seeking Restoration and Healing Through Inquiry. And that was presented as a visual ethnography. And I wanted to present co-researchers' observations of our inquiry process alongside photos that we had taken. And we produced narratives and we co-authored that piece and we supplemented the photographs of our activities through those narratives. And we really wanted to show what it looks like to do critical participatory inquiry. And in our case, it involved community consultations like town hall meetings to understand the research agenda, come up with our own research questions as a collective. It included storytelling sessions based on the Maya oral traditions. And then it included interactive data collection and analysis techniques that we all learned together. And then the last manuscript was based on narrative inquiry, and that one was titled "Can Research Heal? Axiological Commitments and Methodological Obligations as Contact Zones or Restorative Validity." And really what I wanted to do there is start to take co-researchers' words and have them act as counter-narratives. And they were flanked against what could be seen as dominant interpretations of methodology, validity, and assumptions on participation and empowerment. So those that you would read about in textbooks or in donor guidelines on what makes good research. And so really it was trying to pit their words against what's seen as valid. And I would say in its totality, it was really produced as a call to action, all three pieces, because we were really interested that researchers and practitioners create forms of inquiry that seek to heal and restore rather than simply prove a point.
Okay. And so when you reflect back on weaving all of those methodologies for the goals that you mentioned, such as transformation and working with community to get to that goal, can you just share a fond memory you had with respect to that? I think our audience might be interested in your experience with that, like on the ground, what happened, a brief story about what happened that you would be mm-hmm. willing to share.
Absolutely. So one of the things that I and our collective have written about is this example of our actual, one of the days that we did participatory data collection and analysis. So we were in San Juan Comalapa, and that in San Juan Comalapa, there's a community memorial site where this community of Kachikel-speaking Maya, they have worked with the Forensic Anthropology Foundation of Guatemala to construct a memorial site to those who were forcibly disappeared. And so this memorial site is a bit different from the types of memorial sites that you would see because it's not produced by, it wasn't created by a government or a foundation or some private entity, like let's say the Holocaust Museum in Washington, DC. It was really conceptualized and created by the community themselves. And just to give a visual, thick description of the site, it's not just a building where there's a community lodge and a plaque that commemorates the names of those who were disappeared. But within that site, the community built it around the mass graves that had been excavated. And rather than covering those holes that had been dug up, their plan was to leave the holes there to show this was land that had been desecrated, and then to put glass or something to protect those holes so people could view them. And alongside those holes, there are what are called nichos, or small tombs. And so it's essentially a cemetery alongside a memorial site. And they wanted to actually make the memorial site kind of this beautiful living museum. And so rather than taking the human remains away from the memorial, they're placed there. And when someone is matched successfully with the DNA of a living family member, then the case number from the human remains is replaced with the actual name of that living individual. So just to note all of that, so you can visualize where and how we were conducting our research, we started our community consultation in the community's lodge, which is called a Nimahai in Kachikel, and we came up with our own research questions, and they were really interested in exploring what's the significance of having identified family members through the forensic anthropology process. What's the significance of not having a family member found? We went through our oral tradition and other interactive data collection analysis. And then it was time for lunch. We sat down for lunch, and one of my co-authors on an article and a co-researcher in our collective, her name is Carmencita Gumez, and she's a Cachical community organizer and leader. And we're having lunch, and she said, "You know, Giovanni, this is great, but when you're asked to participate, but no one's ever asked you before, you're afraid." And that really struck me, because you go into a lot of neighborhoods, community sites, like as researchers, we talk about the research site. And this wasn't the first time she had been involved in research or program evaluation about her experiences. But she still said, when someone asks you to participate for the first time. So she had been involved in all of these research and evaluation processes, but no one had ever asked her before. And I think that was this, like, this beautiful but also heart-wrenching tension of the work that we talk about being critical participatory inquirers, but we think we may not question if participants feel whether they have sufficient power to participate alongside us as co-researchers, as participants. And so I think that continues to ground my work. It grounded my dissertation. And it's really, it's something that I probably look at that quote on a weekly basis as a way to bring myself back to the significance that she placed around the work.
Thank you for that, for sharing that memory. It gives us a sense of what it was like on the ground, if you will, and as a result, the impact it's had on you personally. So that's very insightful. I want to pull back, if I may, and you talked about what's inspiring you now as a result of the research during the process, but what inspired you to do the dissertation in the first place with this particular community?
Yeah, so I would say I have to go pretty far back to what inspired me. I would say from my own personal experience, I grew up in what's considered like a low-income rural area of California. I grew up with immigrant parents and in a multi-generational household, and was unfortunately a part of too many research studies as a kid. And you often, I think, forget about those things, but from my experiences of being the quote unquote researched, and I didn't feel like a participant, I was a subject in that case, but you know, you start, as you get older, you start to see the reports that come out. You can even look them up. And you start to think about, like, how does it feel to be the researched, to be the subject, to be seen through the eyes of the researcher? And that really started motivating my own research questions, my own inquiry process. Before I went into my PhD, I was doing participatory action research with human rights activists and community organizers in different parts of the world. And I remember doing a participatory project in Burma or Myanmar. And this was with former political prisoners. And they, some of them had been imprisoned for 3 years. Some had been imprisoned for 23 years, but they, it was when the country had decided to reintegrate many of those political prisoners back into society. And I was working for an organization that was trying to help with that reintegration process. So we did a participatory research project. And I just like kept having this feeling after we were finishing up, like, was this more transformative for me or for them? Did I just other them through this process? Did I continue their subjugation as researched, as research subjects? And so when I went into my own doctoral program, I came in with the question, like, for whom is research transformative? For me, for the researcher, the researched, both, and really trying to understand, can research be restorative, especially when we're working, trying to work alongside communities that have seen atrocities, that have witnessed traumas, that have had some sort of loss. So I would say that was really my motivation for this dissertation, and continues to be the motivation for my work.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you reminded me of something I tell my own students, which is a lot of our research is rather personal. And I hear you when you say how you've been in, you know, research and those experiences led you to think better about the way you wanted to treat people that you work with. So thank you for that. I wanted to now turn to a related but slightly different topic. I do understand that you teach at the University of Georgia, and as part of your teaching there, I believe that you include information on participatory inquiry. So I was wondering, when you are teaching on the topic to your students, what are some of the important takeaways based on all the experiences that you just shared, for example, that you want your students to have concerning participatory inquiry? What are some central takeaways that you want to make sure students know and understand?
Yeah, I would say a lot of questions that I get around participatory inquiry are around the idea of how do you create relationships, or how do you build relationships with community members, and also how do you think about the relationship piece is important, but I would also say sometimes people see participation as like through its instrumental value. So they just think, they'll use terms like buy-in, community buy-in. And I think that's one of the things that I have to push back against when I cover these topics, that we're not like trying to get communities to buy in to the process, that we're not there to manipulate or coerce them into the research process. And that's, of course, not something that most people want to do anyway when they do participatory research. But I think we're often socialized into thinking very pragmatically, like just from the instrumental value of interaction and participation, and really stressing that there's a difference between getting people to interact in the research process. It's a lot different, you know, asking people to put a bunch of post-it notes around a room as opposed to like really engage in dialogue.
Yes.
And
agreed.
I actually told this to a class a couple weeks ago that, you know, when you do activities like that, that are very interactive, they can co-opt the whole paradigm of participatory action research, because at face value, they look participatory. You're getting people to move around, to think, to write, but really, you know, at best, it's coercive, and at worst, it's manipulative. If you're not really unpacking those ideas that, you know, if you go back to the work of Paulo Freire, he said, you know, dialogue is the truly resistant act. To really think that, you know, if we're to push against, as Michelle Fine says, that researcher researched hyphen in her, she has that article, Working the Hyphens, like, how do we break down the subject-object relationship where we both both become subject, that participants or co-researchers are actually co-researchers because they can disagree with me, because they can say no, because they tell me what's motivating them as opposed to what's motivating me. So I think those are really important ideas. And from there, through that thinking reflexively, hopefully it becomes easier to think about how do you build and retain relationships, because I often don't think that there is much of a difference maintaining and building personal relationships as there is with research relationships, because again, you just have to think that you're a human being first and then a researcher. And if you treat people like human beings first, as opposed to research first, then hopefully you're doing things in the right way.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. That was very insightful. And I am sure your students and others are inspired by you. So that leads me to another question, which is, which scholars or other people, who inspires you?
Yeah, first I'll say, we'll see if my students are inspired from my course feedback this semester. Scholars who inspire me. So I think...
Or other people.
Yeah. Well, I love your work on privilege. I'm looking at the other side of privilege as researchers and evaluators. I think sometimes we don't unpack our privilege sufficiently. We try to decenter ourselves so much that we forget that we have something to give, that we do have capacities. I also think it was important for me in the dissertation work and to continue for my own research to really read broadly, because I do find myself at that juncture between critical social theories and critical methodologies and peace, rights, and justice studies.
Right.
And I would say one of the things even with peace, rights, and justice studies is that those who work on peace and conflict studies versus those who work on human rights versus those who work on justice don't always use the same theories and they don't always agree on things. And so because I found myself reading broadly across these disciplines, I also felt it was necessary to read across various geographies, various spaces. First off and foremost, I have to credit the work of John Stanfield. And he had this piece from 1996 speaking on the restorative qualities of qualitative inquiry. And he was really pushing researchers. It was a call to action back in 1996. And I recommend that article to any researcher interested in understanding the restorative qualities of inquiry. But then he also had this piece from 1999 on relevance validity. And he noted that if relevance is not achieved in a study, then it doesn't matter how rigorous it is, your study probably produced little societal impact. I would say, of course, listeners are probably familiar with Patty Lather's work on catalytic validity. Methodologically, Michelle Fine's work on her critical participatory action research inside and outside of schools, but then kind of throwing back to the old school, Orlando Falls Borda, Rajesh Tandon, Bud Hall, who all wrote on, you know, the ingredients for participatory action research, ideas of knowledge democratization, and then this kind of like revolving concept of justice, whether it's epistemic justice, Miranda Fricker writes on that, but then also many indigenous scholars around the world, like Linda Tuhuai-Smith or Bagele Chalisa, talk about concepts of, you know, whose knowledge counts. How do we even recognize knowledge? I think that goes back to the idea of recognition and also non-recognition. And then questions of ontological justice. I had mentioned one of my articles was framed around a quote by W.E.B. Du Bois, and then Frantz Fanon, because I draw quite a bit from decolonizing theories. And then I would say restorative justice. It was defined by a scholar named Howard Zaire, but he was inspired by a number of theories and also spiritualities, religions. But I wanted to really complicate that idea of restoration or reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And a lot of scholars have really picked it apart and said, you know, what are we restoring back to? Because it's often a fantasy that never was. And so I was really looking, inspired by the work of this Indian sociologist and anthropologist, and his name is Ananta Kumar Giri. And he talks about that dialectic nature of compassion and confrontation, that they both have to work in tandem for there to be some sort of reconciliation. So I would say those scholars really inspired my work and continue to inspire my work.
Well, that is a broad group of scholars that you just presented there. And seeing as though they're so broad, I'm curious to know, and I think our audience will be too, particularly doctoral students who may be in the process of writing their dissertation. What was your process? I mean, you did win an award for your dissertation. And so it might be helpful for others to think about how an award winner, the writing process for your dissertation.
Yeah. Well, first, there's a lot of luck in getting any award. I think the process.
Fair.
Yeah. For me, it was easier to write a three-article dissertation to mm-hmm. frame my thinking. I think my doctoral advisor, Dr. Megan Call Cummings, she probably realized from the onset that, like, you know, three articles, this is where his head needs to be, because I could then appropriately frame them. For me, and what I tell a lot of my students now, is that you really need to think about your conceptual framework. Whose theories are you drawing on? What are the tacit theories that you're bringing from your own life experiences? And then a lot of the students who I work with, I make them map it out, like physically draw it. And I did that from my own experience, because another one of my advisors, Dr. Rodney Hobson, he kept saying through like two or three meetings, "Where's your map? Where's your map?" And I just got tired of hearing it. And then I just drew the damn map. So then I just put the map on paper. But that really helped me start to draw the connection, like literally draw connections of how do all these topics relate across critical social theories. And when I say critical social theories, I don't mean just like the Frankfurt School social theories, but I was drawing on what's often incorrectly termed the post-colonial, which should really I see as more of the decolonial or decolonizing, and how you take all of those critical social theories and look at the tensions within them, but then what are some of the connections across other fields, like our methodological writing, and then the peace, rights, and justice pieces. And so that really started helping me think about all of the themes in my conceptual framework. And so I went mm-hmm. from a very broad map into a table where I put all of those themes from my readings, and I grouped all of those scholars across various themes. So that helped me to start seeing the connections. And one thing that I needed to do as a critical participatory researcher was I brought in the personal communications from co-researchers and I cite them
Nice.
alongside foundational scholars.
Nice.
So really working on that first piece helped me. And then I would say having the second article is a case study. Again, I think case study is often misunderstood a lot because we don't properly like bound systems. And so it really helped me think about how do we help people see what this work looked like. The third article, I don't remember how I did that one because that one was a mess, and but it worked out.
Sometimes it's like that. So there you have it,
but
folks.
Yeah, I think a lot of mapping helped out.
Mapping is key. Noted. And I know from personal communication and just having worked with you that you have a varied background. So you've done many things before your current position at the University of Georgia as an assistant professor. Can you just briefly share what led you to your current position as a professor?
Yeah, so my first job out of undergrad was doing policy research and program evaluation on social protection mechanisms in Europe. And then I moved to Cambodia and worked on similar topics. And I would say for about 10 years, I worked doing research and evaluation on human rights issues, working closely with human rights activists and community organizers around the world. And so that took me away from school for about a decade. And then I think my spouse got tired of hearing me talk about doctoral programs. And so she kind of pushed me. And then I was lucky to find a good group of advisors at George Mason University in their research methodology department, as well as policy studies and their peace and conflict school. And yeah, I did that for about 4 years and then somehow luckily found myself here at the University of Georgia.
I know they are fortunate to have you there and all of the contributions that you've made to their program. You briefly mentioned while conducting your dissertation research that you had some ethical tensions. I didn't know if you wanted to share anything else regarding your ethical aims or tensions regarding your work. So if so, here's your opportunity to do so. If not, that's fine too, but I just wanted to offer that.
You know, thank you for putting me on the spot. I would say I think there are a lot of ethical tensions when we do any sort of research. I keep a reflexive journal with all of these questions, but I often have to ask myself, is this work simply interactive, or is it actually moving toward having us think critically through dialogue? I also think because I work often with nonprofits or government agencies who are interested in researching and evaluating their work around human rights, I have to ask myself, is that nonprofit or government agency ready to think reflexively not as a monolith, but those who I'm working with in those organizations. And that was one of the reasons that I had come up with these reflexive guiding questions in that first manuscript, really focusing on what would it take for us to produce inquiry that could be restorative for researcher researched, and also how do we restore the humanity behind the research process itself? So asking questions like, you know, who has done research with this community or these communities? Mm-hmm. What harms may they have seen through the research process? How are you going to hold yourself accountable to the community while also having the obligations that you have for your university or your employer.
Right.
So I think those motivated a lot of the questions that I put into that first manuscript. And I think that for me, at least, it was helpful to put them down on paper. I got some pushback from peer reviewers, you know, questioning like, oh, can you really do this? And, you know, yes, you can. You may not be the most you may not be the most productive publishing, but you may feel better about yourself. So I think, you know, there are a number of ethical concerns that I continue to have. But yeah, I think we have to see it as a process.
Listen, I know you said I put you on the spot, but those were absolutely what I call nuggets. Those were some good nuggets. Nuggets are important things that you were sharing, and they're very valuable. That's a nugget. So thank you for those nuggets. That's what I say in class. So thank you for those nuggets. No, you're walking a lot of territory there with, I hear you say a call for action throughout this time together. That seems to be a theme of your work. And so embedded in calls to action, we know that there's always ethical tension. So I appreciate that. To kind of wrap our time together up, I did want to give the viewers a chance to hear you talk about, so what are you up to now?
What am I up to now? So this is the promotional part. So I do have as you mentioned, a co-authored textbook that recently came out. It's called Critical Participatory Inquiry, an Interdisciplinary Guide. And that was co-authored with Megan Call Cummings and Melissa Halber-Ozer. And that was published by Sage. We have a co-edited volume that also recently came out, and that's the Routledge Handbook on Transnational Critical Participatory Inquiry. So really trying to understand how do you do participatory inquiry across borders, whether those borders are national borders or other lines of sovereignty. And what else? So all of the articles from my dissertation can be found in journals. They've been published. I'm really thinking about this idea of known methods, and that this idea is around the topic of how we deconstruct and de-ideologize the everyday. And that's from the theories of Martín Varo, where he said everyone has their own virtues. If we're working with communities, it's made me start to think about like, what are the methods that we bring through our everyday, not just the methods that we're taught or socialized to think about within the academy, whether those are interviews or focus groups, but how do we think about before we were quote unquote educated, how did we come to know? How did we analyze? How did we address issues through our relationships, through our communities, and really looking at family traditions and family learning. And yeah, I'm also interested in this idea of how do we curate restorative spaces, especially when working with youth who have unfortunately maybe not seen or experienced education or schooling as a very educational endeavor. So I would say, you know, that's really what I'm focusing on right now.
The audience can't see this huge smile I have on my face because I am so excited for you, Giovanni. I have been following you and your work for some time and just thrilled to think about what's coming up next. Where can folks find your book by Sage? Where can they find that book? On critical participatory inquiry, where can they get that?
You can buy it directly from Sage. or Amazon, and a number of other bookstores.
Well, that was my final question. Do you have anything else you'd like to share with our listening audience before we conclude our time together, Giovanni?
No, I would just say, you know, if you haven't read Jori Hall's work, then you're missing out.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I appreciate the time that you set aside to chat with me today. This was a treat for me. I hope you enjoyed this experience, and I look forward to seeing you in person next time. For now, talk to you later, Giovanni.
Thank you.